at 10:30 a.m. at the Occidental Community Center in downtown Occidental.
The smart money's on Harlem, and the moon is in the street, and the shadow boys are breaking all the laws. And you're east of East St. Louis, and the wind is making speeches, and the rain sounds like a round of applause. And Napoleon is weeping in the carnival saloon. His invisible fiance's in the mirror. And the band is going home. It's raining hammers, it's raining nails. It's true, there's nothing left for him down here. And it's time, time, time. And it's time, time, time. And it's time, time. Time that you love, and it's time, time, time. And they all pretend they're orphans, and their memory's like a train. You can see it getting smaller as it pulls away. And the things you can't remember tell the things you can't forget. The history puts a saint in every dream. She said she'd stick around until the bandages came off. But these mama's boys just don't know when to quit. And Matilda asked the sailors, all those dreams or all those prayers? So close your eyes, son, and this won't hurt a bit. Oh, it's time, time, time. It's time. Time, time, time that you love, and it's time, time, time. Well, things are pretty lousy for a calendar girl. The boys just dive right off the cars and splash into the street. And when they're on a roll, she pulls a razor from a boot, and 1,000 pigeons fall around her feet. So put a candle in the window, and a kiss upon his lips, as the dish outside the window fills with rain. Just like a stranger with the weeds in your heart, and pay the fiddler off till I come back again. Oh, it's time, time, time. It's time, time, time. And it's time, time, time that you love. And it's time, time, time. And it's time, time, time. And it's time, time. Time. And it's time, time, time that you love. And it's time, time, time.
Welcome back, and welcome to another sunny afternoon in West County. You are listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and I'm your host, Andrew Lewis. For those of you who are just joining you, this is a long-running story, a whole bunch of interwoven tales that include a story about a walk taken to a mountain back in the 1990s, an installation done in a Catholic church, some bits and parts of the Arabian Nights, and a lot of other stories between here and there that also include some tales of the core of discovery, and it's a whole bunch. If you want to start from the very beginning, you can listen to previous episodes on the KOWS website. Just look for the mountain page. Or you can look for, or you can Google the a mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and pull up the Substack, which hopefully will have some of these episodes on it, as well as links to the Spotify podcast version of this story. So it's a lot of listening. Consider it a bedtime story. For the last 160 days, I've also been incorporating stories from the Arabian Nights because of our intervention in that part of the world, that world that gave us really the birth of Western and actually European civilization. It gave us mathematics. It gave us the narrative form. It gave us agriculture. And somehow it should probably be honored for those great gifts that have been given to humanity coming out of Persia and Arabia and the Central Asia. In the story I was telling, we left off with a poor fisherman who had cast his net to the sea to try and bring something to the surface, to try and bring some fortune into his life. And he ended up hauling out of the sea a jar that had been sealed with lead, and he had pried out the top, and out of that jar emerged this smoke, this incredibly vast cloud of smoke that clouded the sky and clouded the entire world, and it formed itself into a genie. What does that have to do with anything? And this genie who looked at the fisherman and said, "I shall kill you now." What does that have to do with anything? In answer to that, I think I best start with this. I best begin with the story of Sidney Toll. So some of you may have heard of her. She's a young girl who died just last week on Wednesday. She was 26. And 3 years ago, at the age of 23, she had been diagnosed with cancer, with something called cholangiocarcinoma. It's this particularly rapacious disease that gives people perhaps 12 weeks to live. This poor young girl, 23 years old, had 12 weeks left to live. And she underwent treatment. She threw everything that she could get at this disease. And she also began to tell her story. She'd go online and she would, on TikTok and on the internet, she shared her story with videos. And she was incredibly beautiful and vibrant. And she gained some renown because at some point some people began to attack her. They said that she was faking it, that there's no way someone could have cancer and could be doing the things that she was doing, that she could be keeping her hair, that she could be keeping her optimism. And yet this force of death that was actually in her body, it was her own cells rebelling against her with this viciousness, essentially destroying her from within. And she came close to vanquishing this disease. Her tumor receded. She had parts of her liver surgically removed, and she took a break. And then this force, this deadly force that was inside of her, reared its head and came back even stronger. And it began to eat away at her with such rapidity, with such force, that she could no longer resist it. No matter what good she brought into the world, no matter what generosity, what kindness, what openness of her heart she brought to the world, this thing, for no reason at all, was set to destroy her. And it did. It took away her last breath on Wednesday, and she's no longer in this world. Despite the love and optimism and hope that she had given so many people. How could the world be that unjust? So that brings us back to our fisherman. Our fisherman who has released this genie that's been imprisoned for 1,800 years in this vessel. And once it's released, it says to the poor fisherman, I shall kill you. I shall kill you. And the fisherman says to this force of death, why would you do that? Why would you do that? Why would you kill me? I saved you. I brought you back to earth. I was kind to you. And this deadly force, this genie said, make a wish. And the fisherman said, well, what should I wish for? And the genie said, I want you to tell me how you want to die, and I will kill you in that way. And the fisherman asked, what was my crime? Why is this my reward for whatever I've done, for the goodness, the kindness that I've brought into the world? And the genie responded, he said, listen to me, listen to my story. And the fisherman set to listen. And the genie said, know that I was once a rebellious force, that I rebelled against the very King Solomon, the prophet of God, the son of David, the one who was sent to the world and was given dominion over the entire world and all living creatures. And I rebelled against him. And he took me by force. He pronounced me guilty. And he told me to submit to his command, and I refused. And so he had me entombed in this brass jar. He locked me up. He sealed it with lead. He stamped the name of God on it. And he had the other forces of the universe throw me into the sea, the other jinn. And I lay there. I stayed there for 200 years. And I thought, whoever saves me, whoever's kind to me, I will give them incredible wealth. But no one came. And so 200 more years passed, and then 200 more, and I thought, whoever saves me, I will give all the treasures of the earth. And yet 400 years went by, and no one came. And after 100 more years, I said, whoever saves me, I shall make them a sultan, and I shall be his slave, and I shall grant him 3 desires, whatever he wishes, 3 desires a day. But those 100 years went by. And after all these years, these hundreds and hundreds of years, no one came to save me. So I raged, and I thought to myself, whoever saves me, whoever grants me kindness, I will kill in the worst way, or I will let him choose the manner of his death. And it's that is how you, poor fisherman, you came to me. And now I ask you how you wish to die. And the fisherman said, just please spare my life. And if you do so, God will spare you. But if you kill me, you will come to an end. And the genie said, I will kill you. So tell me how you wish to die. And the fisherman pleaded. He said, may God not part me from my children. Please, please just save me. And the jinn said, your death is your reward. That's the only reward you shall have. The fisherman pleaded again, I was kind to you. I did you kindness. How can you reward me with this? And the fisherman said, he thought to himself, this is only a jinn. It's a dark spirit. Well, I am human, and God gave me reason. He gave me the power to think and the power to consider my situation and to consider a way toward freedom. The genie has only his ways, but I have my power of thought. So he said to the genie, this force of death, he said, must you kill me? And the jinn said, I must. And then the fisherman said, by the almighty name of God carved on the seal of Solomon, if I ask you a question, will you tell me the truth? And the jinn, he shuddered at the name of God, and he said, "Be brief." And at this moment, the morning gained on Shahrazad, and she cut her speaking short. And her sister Dunyazad, who had lay on the ground on the carpet beside her and the Sultan, said, "What a strange tale." And Shahrazad said, "If I am allowed to live another night, I can tell you far stranger." And the king Shahryar decided that he would spare Shahrazad till the story's end, and that then he would kill her the very next day.
My 40s are kicking my ass and handing them to me in a margarita glass. I was infatuated with an older man, and then I dated a psychopath. So I'm 44 in 2020. Like a shot of good luck, I got a puppy in a truck. If you feel like giving up, shut up, get a puppy in a truck. I don't fuck with Mopar, Tesla, or Ford. I'm a Chevrolet Angel Lord, trading my 64 Malibu for a van. And to tell you the truth, that's the only regret I have. I need a dog that's hypoallergenic, and the poodle may you and photogenic. Like a shot of good luck, I got a puppy and a truck. If you see us rolling up, thumbs up, puppy and a truck. Like a shot of good luck, I got a puppy and a truck, and some unconditional love. Like a shot of good luck, get a puppy and a truck. If you see us rolling up, say what's up. Puppy in a truck.
From where the dog had come, we'll never know. Basque fishermen had bred Newfoundlands from Great Pyrenees stock. As a pup, the dog might have traveled down the Allegheny from New York to Pittsburgh. In summer of 1803, Meriwether Lewis found himself in Pittsburgh on the Ohio River while he awaited the completion of the keel boat that he would float downriver to the Mississippi and then up to St. Louis, from where he would formally embark on his expedition. In a letter, Lewis recorded that he had picked up the dog for $20, a half month's salary. Welcome back to the mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. And I'm your host, Andrew Lewis. We all tread these lives of ours with fellow travelers, some preserved, some forgotten. But if you can, if it's at all within you, it's always good to remember. Though we have no description of the dog named Seaman, a full-sized Newfoundland of the early 19th century would have measured 6.5 feet from head to tip of tail. In the fall of 1803, the dog would accompany Lewis down the Ohio to the Mississippi, and then upriver to St. Louis, where Lewis and his co-captain, William Clark, built out the Court of Discovery. In Cincinnati, Lewis had stopped to examine the bones of a mammoth to identify the nature of the great beast that he had been ordered to seek. Lewis also wrote to the president asking for vaccines so that he could inoculate himself and the Corps members from smallpox. Jefferson had already provided cowpox matter, which was to be used specifically to inoculate the Indians that the Corps would encounter. Lewis and Clark and their men would camp across the river from San Luis and would overwinter there until March of 1804. During that time, Lewis would run the streets of the frontier town, gathering census and geographic information, recruiting men, assessing out the quantity of beaver pelts being brought in from the frontier, and the number of rounders and landless people who were already pouring west across the Mississippi to squat in the newly acquired territory. It can be assumed that seamen accompanied Lewis wherever he went, as much curiosity as a companion. When the Corps departed St. Louis in spring 1804, the Corps members pulled the skiffs and boats upriver. It was rough going. The current was strong and wild. Lewis pretty much walked most of the way on the upper banks, and the dog seaman would have walked beside him, across the Missouri Territory and the eastern edge of what one day would be Kansas and Nebraska, through the Dakotas, and all the way to the Great Falls in Montana. He was Lewis's near constant companion. Each night, regardless of what the day had brought, Clark and Lewis would have stayed up until midnight, and on the cloudless evenings would measure the angle of transit of the moon as it passed proximate to several stars. The measurements were tedious and would take an hour or more. Seamen would have sat beside the two men as they stared at the stars. In the winter at night, the enormous dog would have slept beside Lewis and kept him warm. The activities of the dog are recorded in the journals. How at the onset of the journey he was so adept at catching squirrels and quick to catch geese. How in the winter of 1803, Lewis refused to sell him for 3 beaver skins. How the dog was a favorite of a buffalo calf that followed them along the river shore. How on May 19, 1805, as they pulled up the Missouri, a beaver bit him through the leg and severed his artery. How he was nearly eaten alive by mosquitoes on the return journey home. How the native people took great interest in this dog, so unlike any they had ever seen. He was large enough to retrieve wounded pronghorn and deer. And how in the August heat he was forced to cool himself in the water. How when the dog was stolen by the Walala, Lewis gave orders to shoot the thieves if they failed to return him, and threatened that upon any more theft, he would not hesitate the massacre of the entire tribe. From Pittsburgh to the Pacific, the Newfie walked the breadth of nearly the entire continent, and he was nearly the cause of a war with the native peoples when he was abducted. The dog accompanied Lewis all the way back home. Upon returning to San Luis in August 1806, Lewis and Clark made their way eastward to Washington. After such a journey requiring such immense fortitude, it's doubtful Lewis would have abandoned his dog. Seaman the Newfoundland would have come with them. This is the dog for which Lewis had threatened to annihilate a tribe, after all. When they arrived in Washington, D.C. in January 1807, Lewis would confer with President Jefferson and tell of all that he had seen. It does not at all require a stretch of the imagination to think Lewis would have brought the dog to the White House to greet the great father and to declare to Jefferson, "This dog here has done things as mighty as any man." Thank you. that year, Lewis traveled to Philadelphia, where for several months he did the preliminary work to support the publication of the journals. He hired botanists and engravers and a mathematician to calculate the coordinates of each of their campsites based on celestial observations. He wrote out receipts to account for expenditures so that he could be reimbursed for the tens of thousands of dollars in drafts that were used to finance the expedition. By 1808, he and presumably his dog had returned to San Luis, where he was serving out his duties as governor of the territory. Distracted by correspondences, policy documents, socializing, drinking, land speculation, courting, boostering, jesting, managing what we might call Indian policy of the Sioux, the Osage, the Kickapoo, Shawnees, Iowas. He established a Masonic lodge in St. Louis. He organized the St. Louis, Missouri River Fur Company. The journals languished. Jefferson in midsummer made entreaties. His letter went unanswered. All through 1808, Lewis wrote nothing. Lewis had been charged with publishing the journals, but there were huge gaps, those things that he had not documented, and there were those things so great in magnitude that he struggled to give them justice. And time was short. Already, versions of the journey written by other members of the Corps had come into print. And the vast technical information would be invaluable for the thousands of settlers pouring into the West. His publisher was pushing him. In 1809, his records show a regular use of opium and morphine. Lewis's behavior and mood became unpredictable. He fell into debt. His public expenditures in the territory went unhonored by the federal government. He fell out of favor with Jefferson. In summer 1809, 3 years after the return of the Corps, Jefferson wrote from Monticello, quote, "I am very often appealed to know when your work will begin to appear, and I have so long promised copies to my literary correspondents in France that I am almost bankrupt in their eyes. I shall be very happy to receive from yourself information of your expectations on this subject. Everybody is impatient for it." Jefferson's letter again went unanswered. In autumn 1809, Lewis would set out for Washington to address his debts unpaid by the federal government and to commence the editing of the journals in Philadelphia. He took with him a medicine larder, including opium, and he traveled with a chest that contained the journals. That journey down the Mississippi in September 1809 would be his last. He was suffering from malaria in the sultry autumn heat. He was depressed and in physical pain. He tried twice to kill himself and had to be restrained. On September 11th, he wrote out his will. Near about current Memphis, he left the river and traveled overland, hoping to protect the journals from an encounter with the British. He'd been drinking and suffered from derangement. With the journals, Lewis set off on horseback northward on the Natchez Trace, the trunk containing the journals carried by a pack horse. He was drinking. By the time they reached the Chickasaw Agency, he was not of sound mind. He asked that if anything were to happen to him, that the journals be sent onward to the ex-president Jefferson. On the evening of October 10th, Lewis arrived at Grinder's Inn, a tumbled log cabin in the woods shy of Nashville. He spent that night pacing and talking to himself quickly in a lawyerly fashion. He cursed himself in a violent manner. Before dawn, on October 11th, Meriwether Lewis loaded a pistol and he shot himself in the head and then again in the chest. When he was found in the morning, he was still alive, cutting his body with a razor. At the time of his death, the publishers contracted to print the journals had received not a single line of the manuscript. His companion Neely would carry the journals onward to Washington, where he would meet Clark and Jefferson in 1809. William Clark would commence with the publishing, but the War of 1812 intervened. It was not until 1814, 8 years after the expedition, that a partial edition of the journals were published. Interest had waned. Memory of the expedition faded. It would not be until 1904, 100 years later, that the complete journals in 8 volumes would be printed. But the full publication of the 5,000 pages and accompanying diaries of the other men would have to wait until the 1960s. We will never know entirely what happened that night on the Trace. There is no evidence that semen accompanied Lewis. No mention of the dog by Miss Grinder. When Lewis died, he was most likely alone. When Clark returned to St. Louis in 1810, he would have been responsible for discharging Lewis's remaining effects. Around 1812, Clark made a donation to the Museum of the Alexandria Mason Lodge of several curiosities and treasures related to the expedition. In the year 862 AD,
The relics of St. Mark were spirited away from Alexandria, the gateway to the Great Pyramids, those monuments of the first Masons. Mark's remains would be wrapped in pork fat and taken to Venice. In 1812, William Clark would bestow upon the great reliquary of the Freemason Hall in Alexandria, Virginia, relics, American relics, sacred things to invest sanctity and power upon this place. William Clark gave them the collar of a dog. In 1814, one John Alden, who as a hobby collected epitaphs, recorded the words written on a dog collar in the museum of the Alexandria Mason Lodge. The greatest traveler of my species, my name is Seaman, the dog of Captain Meriwether Lewis, whom I accompanied to the Pacific Ocean through the interior of the continent of North America. What blazes, what marks do we leave in history, as if to say, we once were here, that I did that? The Natchez Trace, 3 or 4 feet into the earth for all the boot and travail hauled upon it, the Indian paths wending up the Jefferson branch of the Missouri could clearly be seen through the scrub prairie grass. And years after the pestilence had winnowed the Chinook bands, their longhouses still stood, moldering in the winter storms and infested with sand fleas. A sailor tattoos his name on the arm of a Clatsop woman. John Coulter carves his name on a rock in the wilderness. Meriwether Lewis carves his name and a date into a tree on the windswept Pacific coast. The collar of a dead dog, cataloged in a small collection of artifacts in a Masonic Lodge museum in Virginia, later to be burned to the ground, so all would be lost. And then we go on. The conversations lost, the footpath lost. In its place, a starved land, scarred with cement freeways, limbed by muffler shops, asphalt parking lots, and convenience stores sporting racks of chips and jerked beef. Future generations have so little to go on. They'll treasure scant evidence. They'll try to untangle truth from untruth. And as for the journals and the great archive from the governance of the Louisiana Territory and the maps and ephemera, William Clark died in St. Louis in 1838. His descendants would make their way north into the Ohio. 3 generations would pass. A matriarch would die, and her children would come to the old house, hoarded up with the possessions the family had stewarded through time. In the attic were trunks of old papers, documents, rusted artifacts, antiquities with unknown histories, feathers and pelts and trunks filled with faded and near illegible writing. From the attic window, they pitched the boxes and bundles of paper into the yard. They piled them high. They doused them with lighter fluid. They struck a match. And they lit them on fire. What is it to keep the holy hour with one in sorrow? Only God exists outside the bounds of time. Only he can intercede across its fabric. I, however, am frozen in my space and in time. I speak to you, Meriwether, as if through a thick pane of one-way glass. You can neither see nor hear me. But speak to you, to pray for you, I must. We imagine people from the past as our seniors. They lived before us, after all. But in this moment, I sit here in contemplation as your elder, as your forebearer, Meriwether. I will soon turn 60. You, despite all that you have done, despite your great leadership, are hardly 35. I would like to say this to you. You led the Corps of Discovery. That body of men charged with discovering the breadth and nature of this land. You were tasked with documenting its languages and flowering and fruiting plants and geologic formations. You were asked to determine if great beasts still roamed the land. But you had fallen short. You were unable to write that report to your superior. You were not able to put into words all that you had seen. The mastodon, the megalonyx, they had existed, and creatures even more fantastical. On this continent, there had been Thessalosaurus and Pterosaurus and Triceratops. Dragons once roamed the land. You and your band had traveled thousands of miles upriver. On July 15th, you noted you had arrived at the confluence of the three forks that fed into the Missouri River. And then you went on. You will never know that a certain Walter Alvarez, a Roman Catholic, would be born in the court of King Charles in Asturias, Spain, in the year 1848, that he would travel to the island of Cuba. He would train as a doctor and marry a physician who had been schooled at Stanford University in what would have been the territory of California. That he would travel to Hawaii and develop a cure for leprosy. That he would have a son, Luis, who would study physics and material sciences, and that his son would invent and design implements of war. That in America, men would learn to soar in the sky. That in America, men would develop a weapon that could destroy the world many times over. That Luis Alvarez would witness when that bomb was dropped on a Japanese city, that hours after extinguishing 80,000 lives, Alvarez would type on a manual typewriter a letter to his son, Walter. That Luis Alvarez would discover that in antediluvian times, an asteroid would have hit our planet and in a fraction of a moment would send a tsunami of water northward all the way to the Missouri Basin, eradicating everything in its path. I want you to know, Meriwether, I want you to know that a day's walk to the south of Three Forks lay the Hell's Creek Formation, perhaps one of the most significant fossil repositories in the entire world. Why do I tell this to you? I tell you this story to distract you and once again fill your mind with wonder. I tell you this story so that you can prevail through this night. I shall not leave you. For all time, I shall not leave. I tell you, so that you can awaken at dawn with renewed vigor. You must remember the great task before you, the one for which you alone are equipped. You are voyaging far to meet your superior. You must have renewed confidence. for you have great, such terribly great news to share.
Why'd you ever let it go that far, drunken angel? You could have held on to that long, smooth neck. Let your hand remember every fret, finger touching each shiny string. But you let go of everything, drunken angel. Drunken angel, you're on the other side. Followers would cling to you, hang around just to meet you. Some threw roses at your feet, watch you pass out on the street, drunken angel. Feed you and pay off all your debts, kiss your brow, taste your sweat, write about your soul, your guts, criticize you and wish you luck, drunken angel. Drunken angel, you're on the other side. Drunken angel, you're on the other side. Tape shoes, your orphan clothes and your long dark hair, looking like you didn't care, drunken angel. Blood spilled out from the hole in your heart, over the strings of your guitar, the worn down places in the wood, the ones that made you feel so good, drunken angel. Side. Drunken angel, you're on the other side. The sun came up, it was another day. When the sun went down, you were blown away. Why'd you let go of your guitar? Why'd you ever let it go that far, drunken angel?
You have been listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and I am your host, Andrew Lewis. Thank you for joining, and I have a special favor to ask. I'd like to ask you to hang on, especially those who might feel a loneliness more profound than any being has a right to bear. Hang on, just for a little while longer. If not for yourself, then please grant me the favor. I so very much would like your company to keep. If you're just joining us, it bears reminding that this is a shaggy dog story that's been going on for a whole lot of months. If you're interested in particular on this, or the sections of this story, or the parts of this story that involve Meriwether Lewis, the Core of Discovery, the dog, I would recommend going back and listening to the previous maybe three or four episodes. So go back. You can find the recordings on the KOWS website, and hopefully by now I should have them up on the Substack page. You could just Google the Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and it should either pull up that or the Spotify version of these stories. I'm again indebted to Stephen Ambrose for his observations and considerations of Meriwether Lewis in his book Undaunted Courage, James Holmberg of the Filson Historical Society in Louisville, Kentucky, who first divined the fate of Seaman's dog collar, and again to my brother for treasuring the memory and great aptitudes of Luis Alvarez. The dog collar had apparently been delivered to Mason Lodge number 22 with the accompanying report that the dog had never left Lewis's hastily prepared grave and had died there of starvation. Although I don't doubt Seaman's loyalty, I don't find this account entirely plausible. It's hard to imagine that Lewis would have taken his life with his beloved dog present. And also that with two bullet shots and a knifing, that the dog would have made no small amount of commotion. Then we have the matter of how the story would have been relayed back to William Clark in St. Louis. Lewis's traveling companion arrived the following morning and hastily buried Lewis before, we imagine, making haste to Washington with the journals. No mention of the dog. And if it had been left behind, who would have relayed his collar and the narrative of his death to William Clark? More likely, I think, that the dog, Seaman, predeceased Meriwether Lewis, and that somewhere on the grounds of the former territorial governor's mansion in St. Louis, there lie the bones of a Newfoundland dog. A small footnote regarding Timothy Alden, the collector of epitaphs. He was prone to both mania and depression. He founded Allegheny College. He was obsessed with trivia. His great contribution to the works of humanity is a 5-volume collection of tombstone inscriptions and narratives of the lives of the dead. We opened with Time, sung by Sebastopol's own Tom Waits. And that was followed with Puppy in a Truck by Jenny Lewis. Dog by Nat Johnson. Howlin' Down the Cumberland, sung by John Hyatt, followed by Alinda Segarra covering Lucinda Williams' Drunken Angel. We'll be putting this to bed with Knuckleball Prime by Willie T. Taylor. The usual reminder, if you have it in you, please subscribe to The Mountain on Substack. The link is in the episode description on the KOWS website, or you can simply just Google The Mountain, An Adoration in a Multitude of Parts, and you should find your way to Substack, as well as the Spotify recordings of this as a podcast in its first incarnation. And by all means, if you enjoyed the listen, and it makes your world a little bigger, I would be grateful and indebted if you would share with your friends. Please have a great day or a good night wherever you are.
Want a shot at the title? I'm in my knuckleball prime. My dogs are tired, but they still got fight. I won't hang it out, boys. Not this time. I'm hitting all the corners, gonna shed some light. When she hits that note, boys, it's all done. Oh, I'm gonna win this one. Oh, here I come. It's been a hell of a road, boys. One hell of a time. And all my heartaches have turned. That pearl, boys, I believe it's time. Cause when she said no, boys, it's all done. Oh, in this one. Oh, here I come. Give me a shot at the title. Drinking champagne when I get to town. All these miles, just kissing the wind.
step of the way has come to this. When she said no, boys, and it's all done. Been a long night waiting on the sun.
Two shows tonight?
Yeah. I hope they didn't use up your vital statistics.
I'm doomed. Two shows, huh? Couldn't have spared me another 20 minutes sleep, another 3 hours worth of sleep. Could have driven down.
The bare minimum power.
Yeah, man.
It's 2 o'clock.